Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's show, Doug Aitken's latest art installation involves diving gear and a trip to Catalina.
You find yourself swimming through a sea of monochrome, kind of blue-gray, and in front of you in the distance, you start making out shapes, these strange geometric shapes, hexagonal shapes.
And why did the German government spend millions of dollars to save a small modernist house in Pacific Palisades? Before we get to that, though, Los Angeles has many nicknames, and one of them, La La Land, is usually not meant as a compliment. But the romantic musical La La Land is an unabashed tribute to this city of celluloid dreams. The film, written and directed by Whiplash director Damien Chazelle, opens this Friday on a wave of Oscar buzz. Ryan Gosling plays Sebastian, a struggling jazz musician who dreams of opening his own club. Emma Stone plays Mia, an aspiring actress.
Maybe I'm not good enough.
Yes, you are.
Maybe I'm not. It's like a pipe dream.
This is the dream. It's conflict and it's compromise. It's very, very exciting.
Their love affair plays out in some of LA's most iconic settings, from Griffith Observatory to Watts Towers, from glamorous backyard pool parties and dimly lit dive bars to maddeningly jammed freeways. La La Land has stunning visuals, and they were largely the creation of a husband and wife team, David Wasko, the production designer, and Sandy Reynolds Wasko, set decorator. The Waskos have worked on several movies in which LA itself is a character, including Pulp Fiction and Collateral. They describe La La Land as their Valentine to Los Angeles and to films about Los Angeles.
It is a love letter to LA, and it's our home city. And both Sandy and I love Los Angeles. And we connected with Damien, who happens to be a very visual director. He had this interest in showcasing the city. So we set out to try to find the most interesting garden court apartment for where Mia lived, or the most kind of downtrodden apartment where Sebastian lived. And some of our locations were in Long Beach. Some were in Hermosa Beach, the Lighthouse Jazz Club. We kind of did a no stone unturned look to try to find the most interesting places throughout.
The story really does unfold through locations. So did the script already suggest the locations, or did it suggest types of locations?
Yes, it was in the script. It did call for the characters to go to an art house movie theater, which wasn't specifically scripted as a Rialto, but I kind of fought for the Rialto because it's such a lovely, threadbare movie theater that's closed right now. But then in the case where they watch Rebel Without a Cause at the Rialto, and then they decide to go to the Planetarium or to go to the Griffith Park, and that was in the script. However, the Planetarium was updated and modernized, and they kind of lost the wonderful deco feeling. So what we decided to do was to build the Planetarium and heighten the deco quality of that. Plus, Damien really wanted the movie to really try to stay away from doing CGI or computer-driven effects. And there was one scene in the Planetarium where the characters have to sort of float off into space. So that had to be done with wire work, and that could not be done in the Planetarium. So we built this rather large, it was actually the full-size Planetarium, and then that's where we did that scene where they lift off into space and go in and do a dance in the stars.
City of stars, are you shining just for me?
And it works for an audience because a lot of people come to LA in their late 20s or later, visitors, and they come with some preconceived notions, mostly from films they've seen or television shows they've seen, or art, even if it's by non-Los Angelinos like David Hockney. There's so many references that you arrive with. You know, Laurel and Hardy from Double Indemnity. There's so many things that you automatically start referencing as you drive through the city and get to know it. And I think that's one reason that the city's history is as alive as its present persona. And as you experience it, all those things mixed together, as well as I'm sure it's particularly hard for young musicians or actors to come into the city because the ghosts of everyone who's gone before are alive and well there.
We referenced a lot of our favorite painters along with Damien, like David Hockney's paintings, Ed Brochet's paintings, Patsy Valdez, the colors of Patsy's paintings. That's what kind of gave it that kind of vibrant look. And the other important reference and influence, the director Jacques Demy's movies, which Damien had us look at. He arranged to have a movie night, at least a couple nights a week, where we would show the entire crew projected movies like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg or The Young Girls of Roquefort. And these are just dazzling Technicolor movies that were done in the mid-60s. And that sort of was our reference for the direction that he wanted us to go.
Let's talk about another really spectacular scene. I don't think we're giving the story away by saying that the opening of the movie is set in a very contemporary, very typically very annoying LA situation, which is a freeway traffic jam. And between your team, you turn this into the most amazing opening.
Again, our job is to translate what's written into reality. And it does say, okay, they're on a traffic jam on the 101, and then everybody gets out and does a big dance number, and we're scratching our heads, how are we going to do this? Well, with the location manager, we narrowed down. There were a few portions of freeway which we were able to actually gain and own and control and shut down that we showed to Damien. But the third one was a leg of the exchange between the 105 and the 110, which is an elevated portion of the freeway. And we showed that to Damien, and he just fell in love with it. He said, can we own this? And we said, yes, we can own a portion of it while the lower part remains functioning in traffic. So we had a window of 2 days where we were able to close the freeway down. First of all, we did a miniature model where we were able to map out everything with the choreographer. But then comes the time where we had a window of being able to close the freeway down. And my big concerns was I thought it was dangerous because there was a very low parapet wall about knee high or so on either side that then led to a 100-foot drop. But we were able to put all the cars in the same configuration as the rehearsal. Lena Sandgren, the director of photography, had a big crane shot that was rehearsed as a continuous crane shot that wove throughout the cars and throughout the dancers. It was, I think, two of the hottest days of the year. It was over 100 degrees when we were doing it, but it worked great and it looked great. And it was one of the clear days where you can see from that exchange to downtown LA, the skyline, and that was important to Damien.
But you couldn't control the weather. You had to plan, you had to book in advance to get that portion of the freeway, so you had to take the weather you got.
Correct.
Now, you shot the film, as we understand it, at 48 locations in 42 days. That seems like an intense schedule. How did you pull this off?
When we were scouting early on with just Damien, and then who joined us also early on was Linus, the cameraman, they used their iPhone and iPad, and they literally filmed the movie. They said, David and Sandy, stand over there and walk this way. This would be Mia and Sebastian. So they filmed the entire movie on their iPhone and iPad, and they had it all figured out prior to them going there with a 35-millimeter camera and shooting it with a 100-person crew. And I'm not used to that. And that rehearsal, if you want to call it that, or that dry run, gave them the leg up on being able to shoot it quickly. So you could probably put an entire movie together with what Damien and Lena shot on their iPhone and iPad.
That would be most interesting to see that film. Now, you two have had a long and extremely illustrious career in film. Directors, you've worked for Quentin Tarantino, you've worked with Wes Anderson. Again, directors with very distinct styles. How did those past experiences sort of influence the work you bring to La La Land?
Well, we were lucky to have worked on a bunch of movies that were depicting Los Angeles. And some of those were early Quentin movies like Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs or Jackie Brown, where we're showing the city in a different way. Plus, there were a few other opportunities that we've had to showcase the city through other directors. For instance, Paul Schrader directed his only comedy, which was Touch, which was another Elmore Leonard story. One of the first movies that I worked on, I was very lucky to work on El Norte, which was Gregory Nava and Anna Thomas's iconic movie that showcases Los Angeles. And we've been very lucky to work with these pretty great writer-directors. And Quentin was Damien's age when we worked with him, and so was Wes. They were 27, 28 years old, and they were great writers. You know, what pulls these kind of great work out of us is somebody like a Damien. He really had this movie in his mind. This script was written prior to Whiplash and was sort of put on the shelf for a bit until he was able to get a little bit bigger budget. So he's had this movie in his mind for a long time, and then he cut it together and ends up with this gem. And there's no rhyme or reason to the success of a movie. There's so many variables. The movie is sort of broken down to these different craftspeople that are all pulled together to then build the movie. And sometimes all of those different people are not on the same page. This was a case where everybody was on the same page, and it was sort of a perfect storm of everything working. And then it's also, I think, the climate with which then a movie is released. People seem to be ready for a movie like this right now. It is a different thing. It's going back to the musical, which was something that helped America during the Depression. And people went to a theater to escape what was happening. And I think that it's all of that together that contributes to the success of the movie. And when it all sparks and works, it is magic.
In terms of all the movies that you have worked on that depict Los Angeles, is there one that, most of all, is your Los Angeles?
I think it's La La Land. That movie was made with love, and it shows.
That was David Wasko and Sandy Reynolds Wasko, production designer and set decorator for the musical La La Land, which opens this Friday. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, the German government saves a house in the name of political idealism.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Frances Anderton. The German government has purchased the former Los Angeles home of one of its most famous and celebrated authors. Thomas Mann grappled with the rise of totalitarianism in his writings, which include Dr. Faustus and The Holy Sinner.
Everybody in Germany who has grown up in school, I think he stands for the good Germany, not the evil, the fascist Germany.
Markus Klimmer is the board chair of the Villa Aurora. That's the German-owned retreat for artists also in the Pacific Palisades. Klimmer spoke to us from his office in Berlin. In 1933, Adolf Hitler became Germany's chancellor. Mann fled Germany and eventually settled in the Pacific Palisades. And there he commissioned a modest-sized house in the modernist style, designed by another German immigrant, J.R. Davidson. Back in Germany at this time, Nazis had targeted modern architecture. Earlier this year, Mann's House went on the market for a listed $15 million. And the listing labelled the house itself as a possible teardown. So why did the Germans step in and buy it?
I mean, just the idea of having this building torn down, I think that caused an outcry in Germany.
And this was a house that Thomas Mann himself commissioned when he came to live in Los Angeles.
I understand he was in discussions with other great architects of the time, but Julius Davidson, who was also a German immigrant. So I think this was a collaboration between Thomas Mann and Davidson.
But the collaboration produced a house that was very modern. And what you're indicating is that the modern dimension of the house played right into the kind of progressive politics of Thomas Mann.
Yes. I mean, I think he toyed with the idea of just buying a colonial-style house, but he wanted to be in Los Angeles. He wanted to make the U.S. his home, and he wanted to express in the building the modernism as well as all the thoughts of the time.
So Thomas Mann left the house in 1952. What kind of state was it in by the time you purchased it?
Well, actually, it's been the same family who's been living in the house ever since. It's the Lappin family. And I think the advantage is the disadvantage. The disadvantage is that maybe in the last 3-4 decades, not a lot has been done to the house. That means it's also in a state that it needs renovation. And that's also the advantage. Not a lot has been done. So we're lucky in a way that it has stayed in the same family. And I think the family is also very happy about the house being purchased by the German government.
And you purchased it pretty much for the market price.
Well, what is a market price? Whenever you come from Germany, you're always shocked about property prices in the U.S., especially Los Angeles, because I think the property is not in the house. It's in the
land.
In the land. And the land seems to have that value that actually to realize the full property value, you have to tear down the house. So for me, the house price is still a shock. But I think this is alongside the market value. And I understand also that there was another buyer who was trying to tear down the house, who offered actually a few millions more than we did. And I'm very, very glad that the family in the end had the courage to say no to an offer of a few millions more and accept the offer of the German government, because we would make sure that the house would pretty much stay the same way it is at the moment.
So Thomas Mann leaves Germany, what was it, 1933? But then he winds up going back. And why is that?
Well, I mean, like in many dictatorships around the world, at the beginning, you don't really know what it's going to end up. Nobody in 1933 thought that this was going to be the Holocaust of 1943 or 1945, and you don't easily leave the home country, the language that you wrote in. And so we're seeing many fascist movements around Europe at the moment. I myself am Austrian, and I'm fighting this populism every day in Austria. And but I don't know what it's going to be like in 5 or 10 years. So I'm trying not to give up my home, my country too easily. And I think this is what a lot of the emigrants did. And lots of them found it very, very difficult to leave not just their country, but leave their language to these people, to these fascists. And I think this is what Thomas Mann was doing, what lots of other people were doing.
But then went back to Germany because he found an unpalatable movement developing in the U.S.,
McCarthyism, and that was one of the reasons why he then in the 1940s and early 1950s considered going back to Europe. Actually went back to Switzerland, not to Germany, but he came to the U.S. and he wanted to make it his home.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you were Austrian. The Austrian government currently owns, I think, the Schindler House and and another building by Rudolf Schindler. Now, the German government owns the Villa, the Feuchtwanger residence, the Villa Aurora, and now the Mann House. Is this normal for governments to sort of step in and buy houses in other cities and establish them as I guess, cultural institutions?
Well, I think I actually see a movement towards this. I mean, the German government has always, when you look at the Foreign Office, has always put an emphasis on being foreign policy, also being foreign cultural policy. So this was one of the pillars of German foreign policy. And I think there is movement also towards artists' residences around the world, because that's a way of making it more sustainable. The West Coast also has a very, very special place in the heart of many of the politicians here, because lots of people used to call it Weimar at the Pacific, because Pacific Palisades, Los Angeles, in the late Weimar Republic, became the home of all these people who had to flee from the Nazis. So I think this is a very, very special place. And I think the film industry in Hollywood wouldn't be feasible without all the German influences as well, of all the emigrants that came to Los Angeles and tried to make a home and make a living there.
Sure. And so that's what the house will serve as, is that right? It's going to be a kind of artist residence.
We're trying to, you know, the neighborhood association hasn't reacted very favorably so far. And I understand that lots of people want their privacy to be respected there. So they're not looking to have this as a kind of a frat house. I think that might be one of the fears that they've got. Young students getting drunk there, nothing like it. And we'll see what we get to. But the German government, of course, would like to see this being used as an artist residence. But I understand it'll take some time to work through all the issues with the neighborhood association.
Yes, there's fascist dictators and then there's neighborhood associations.
That's a comparison that I wouldn't make.
That was Markus Klimmer, chairman of the board of the Villa Aurora and also chairman of the board of directors of the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Now we take you to someplace special, underwater.
Three pavilions, kind of very large kaleidoscopic caves that are floating.
They are a little creepy. If you're not expecting this orb in the ocean that's glowing, it can be pretty scary.
Suddenly you're not anymore in the oceans, you're somewhere in space, in the universe.
Somewhere in space happens to be just off the coast of Catalina Island, and the orb referred to as one of three sculptures that make up artist Doug Aitken's new installation, Underwater Pavilions, which opens Sunday. KCRW's Eric Drachman travelled Catalina Island for this story.
Doug Aitken's retrospective exhibit, Electric Earth, is on display at the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA's Little Tokyo neighborhood. Getting to his latest installation takes a bit more effort. You have to drive to the port, pay for parking, buy a ticket for the ferry, and wait in line to board.
Again, 70 minutes to you. Avalon is attacked with oxygen.
Off the boat, it's a quick stroll into the charming tourist town of Avalon. The installation is on the other side of town, in the Casino Point Dive Park, in front of the Catalina Casino with its famed Art Deco ballroom. The artwork is only 100 yards or so from shore. The turquoise glow around them stands out from the dark blue sea. With all the gear and the weights, I walk like an awkward, heavy robot down some steps that lead right into the water. I swim out a little and dive down. Suddenly, I'm on another planet. Hundreds of fish are staring back at me. Bright orange Garibaldi, calico bass. All I can hear is the sound of my breathing. Breath in, bubbles out. And I can fly. Or that's how it feels anyway, like I'm floating through space. I swim toward the three glowing orbs.
As you swim closer, you find yourself, I think, really in the present. You find yourself kind of caught in that moment with nothing else in your mind.
That's how Doug Aitken describes it. That's how I always feel when scuba diving. But what's different about this experience is what I see next.
You find yourself swimming through a sea of monochrome, kind of blue-gray, and in front of you in the distance, you start making out shapes, these strange geometric shapes, hexagonal shapes.
The three sculptures all float at different depths. One has mirrors on the outside, where I can see myself and the vast blue ocean behind me. The other two have mirrors on the inside. Those are the ones Joel Wilson, a local dive instructor, really likes.
Because it's kind of like a scuba diving changing room. You go inside and you can kind of see yourself from all angles and you really kind of get a sense of, oh, what I look like when I'm scuba diving.
They all have a textured surface designed for sea life to cling to and live on. They're really big, like 12 feet or so. Big enough to swim inside, look in the mirrors, turn around and swim out through one of the hexagonal openings. Back on land, I feel different. I feel at peace. Swimming through these sculptures was a cool experience, but getting to them was challenging. Aitken says it's not just an inconvenience.
I think there is something about taking this boat over there that kind of allows you to slow down and decelerate in a way. That disorienting sense of suddenly stepping into a completely different field of experience.
Aitken has a history of taking his audiences out of the traditional museum or gallery spaces. He's staged performances on a train traveling across America and has had large-scale video installations on a barge floating off the coast of Athens. But is the Catalina Project more than just a fanciful art installation in a remote location? Cyril Gutch, founder of the environmental organization Parley for the Oceans, says there's more below the surface. His group has partnered with Doug Aitken Studio and MoCA on this project.
The oceans are under such a massive threat, and still nobody really knows or cares because the sea feels like so far away from everyday life, and nobody really understands why it is necessary actually to protect the sea.
Parley doesn't focus on protests, but rather employs art to raise consciousness about the plight of the oceans.
Jacques Cousteau said in a very nice way, people only protect what they love, and art is the perfect way to create that love, to kind of close the gap that is between us, mankind, and that life that feels so distant, so far away, and still we are so depending on it.
For most of us, Aitken says the Pacific Ocean is so vast.
We don't really know where to go or what to see or how to approach it, so it becomes intimidating. It becomes this kind of dark, mysterious mass. The idea of the underwater pavilions is to create something which is almost like an aperture. It's almost like a door into the ocean.
And for Parley, Doug Aitken's art can make that connection.
It's like a bait, in a way, to lure people down to discover, to explore.
For the town of Avalon, this is bait to further attract tourists to the island. And according to Richard Huband at the local scuba shop, there's already plenty of interest from the mainland, too.
Oh, absolutely. We've had people call just to come and see the sculptures. So, yeah, we'll get more divers because they want to come and see them.
In fact, divers travel to see great wrecks around the world. So this will be a draw for divers. But will it be a draw for art lovers in general? The sculptures are expected to stay where they are for at least the next 3 months. You just need to drive, park, take a ferry to Catalina, rent your gear if you need it, and dive. The trip could cost $200, and that's if you don't stay overnight. If you'd rather experience underwater pavilions from dry land for free, they're in the process of installing a live video and audio feed of the sculptures.
Someone can be in New York or in Berlin, and they can open up their tablet or their phone, and they can be inside these pieces in real time.
That sounds great, but if you can, I say make the trip. Get in the water, see it up close. For DNA, I'm Eric Drachman.
Eric's story comes to us through KCRW's independent producer project. And we have photos and more at kcrw.com/DNAblog. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.